Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to a fresh episode of Wiedersehen. My name is Masbjørn Schmidt and I'm a professional cyclist. This podcast is about all the stuff we experience on our journey as cyclists when the TV cameras are off. This is an episode I've been looking forward to shoot. With me for this podcast is my teammate Chris Froome, four-time winner of the Tour de France and every other race a GC rider would ever dream of winning. We just finished Dauphiné and went straight to the top of a mountain in the French Alps for a training camp. So we sat down for a talk about Chris and his life since turning pro in 2008. Thank you for listening. If you like this podcast, I would be very happy if you would leave a comment and give me some ratings. So, Chris Froome, welcome to my podcast. I am happy to do this episode with you. We are in the Alps, in the mountains. We are in the cloud most of the day, training after Dauphiné. And how are you feeling?
Cheers, Matt. Yeah, thanks for having me on your podcast. We're up in the mountains again. feels like the story of my life, really. If I'm not at a race, I'm always up in the mountains somewhere training and preparing for the next goal. And we've just come out of the Dauphiné. Dauphiné was a pretty full gas week of racing.
As usual.
So yeah. Nice to have a few easy days together and still be with the team and hopefully shaping up, working towards the Tour de France.
Yeah. Last time I saw you was in Romandy, and you progressed quite a lot since then. You were in training camp in Tenerife before here, so
yeah,
you seem a lot better.
Yeah, I think things are certainly heading in the right direction. Yeah. I think from the outside, people still see that I'm not at the front fighting for the victory yet, and I think a lot of people can be quite critical and not really knowing exactly where I've come from.
Yeah.
But certainly people closer to the story and people who can see the progression and see, for example, how far I've come this season already, I think would have a much better judgment of that. So yeah. I'm really, really happy, really staying very positive, very upbeat that things are heading in the right direction now. It's still going to take a lot more work to get back to where I left off before the big crash, but I'm staying optimistic and hoping that I just need to keep my head down, keep working, and hopefully I'll get there.
Yeah. I think most of the critics, they are people who don't really know cycling. Because in the peloton, a lot of guys, like I've been talking around, and a lot of guys, they have serious respect for you from what you've come from. So that's also nice to hear around in the peloton.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thanks, man. No, I mean, it's amazing to see the sport, I mean, from within the peloton and even from fans. I mean, a lot of people have been on this journey with me. This year I've tried to open up a little bit more and share a little bit more of my journey with fans on YouTube. And it's just been amazing, the sort of response from people and the number of people getting in touch and obviously wishing me all the best in terms of the recovery.
Yeah.
It's pretty special.
Yeah. So we're training camp. You're at training camp once again. I guess it's the fourth or fifth of this year.
Yeah, it feels like my life is just one big training camp. I mean, Yeah, I love being at home with obviously I've got two really young kids at the moment, so I mean it's a lot of time on the road, especially with them, so it's a lot of pressure on my wife to be looking after them. But I think it, given the job that we're doing, it's just so full on. I mean, professional cycling, the way I see it is you give it everything, or you can just give up right there, because it's a lifestyle. It's not just a job. It's a way of living.
Yeah, but you're the type of rider who use training camps more than racing to get in shape, if I'm correct.
Yeah, typically.
And
yeah,
historically, why is that?
I'd say historically, I mean, I spent a lot of time in training camps, because obviously in training environment, you can control very much what kind of workouts you're doing, what kind of sessions you're doing, what you're actually working on to improve. Whereas when you go to a race, you're basically just, obviously, you're following the wheel, you're sprinting out of corners, you it's a very different animal, a race to a training camp.
Yeah, you're also a climber, and
yeah, I mean, most of the camps,
I think I gain more from doing races than training camps, because I need those accelerations for the stuff that I'm good at. So maybe that's the difference between guys like you and guys like me.
Yeah, I think strangely enough, that's actually where I'm probably finding it the hardest at the moment, is to get back into that race rhythm with all the accelerations in the peloton and everything. So I could definitely do with a few more race days in the legs. I definitely feel that whenever I do a race, I come out feeling better than I went in. So
yeah, good. So the podcast is called Rytterjargon. In Danish, it's Rytterjargon, and it's like rider lingo, and every guest brings some rider lingo to the podcast. So let's hear it.
there's one word that, I guess, for the last decade, that has always, I guess, defined moments in the race for me, and that word probably came from maybe the British influence on the team. Yeah. At Sky, and that word is squeeze. Has to be said like that, so it's
I'm gonna put that on my cover picture.
And it's basically, it's that moment in the race where everyone's kind of on the limit. You've been climbing probably for 20-30 minutes already, like, and it's that moment that you're gonna make the difference in the race, and you ask one of your teammates, okay, it's time now. Squeeze.
You call on the radio and you say squeeze.
Get on the radio and be like, okay, come on, man, squeeze. And it's pace just goes up another 20-30 watts, and you can just see, okay, when that guy pulls over, that's the time to attack. So
nice, that's a good one. That's a really good one, actually. Okay, so I have these questions I ask for everybody. Your favorite training loop?
Favorite training loop?
Yeah.
I'd probably say, living down in the south of France, just out of Monaco, the training from there is incredible. We're really spoiled with the mountains down there. I mean, obviously it's busy in the city and down on the coast, but typically most of us who live in Monaco, we go straight back into the mountains when we go training. And there's a loop I like to do out there, which basically goes directly back into the mountains, and one of the most quiet, unspoiled roads around there is Col de Saint Roche. It's kind of, you go through these very small villages, like mountain villages. It's a lot of rivers, a lot of forests, and it's climbing. I mean, you're climbing all day, basically. Yeah. And from there, you can get up to, from Col de Saint Roche, you get up towards the top of Turini, which is close to 2,000 meters.
Yeah. And you start at zero, basically.
And you're starting at sea level. So that's probably, you can do a 4 or 5 hour ride and you're up at 2,000 meters and back down to sea level again. So it's probably one of my favorite loops.
And you have specific work for this loop, or you just
not really.
I wouldn't where you normally just smash it every time. Or?
Yeah, I wouldn't normally go and do intervals there. Quite often, I'd enjoy going and doing it with a friend, so you've got someone to speak to, but just ride like a solid tempo on the climbs, and I just reminisce, I guess. Days I used to go up there with Richie Port, just two of us kind of like half wheeling each other all the way up and trying to get one over each other, but definitely made us strong that loop.
Yeah, cool. And important one, are you a coffee stop guy?
Yes and no. I think there are times of the year where I definitely need a little bit of motivation to get me that little bit further away from home. And by choosing a good coffee stop, it's like, okay, that gives me a goal to get to that point.
Sometimes I even ride just for the coffee stop.
Yeah, it's exactly. I mean, especially around sort of November, maybe when you're just getting back into it, January, even when the weather's not great and you're just like, oh, I don't really want to go outside.
Yeah.
But, especially being where we're based down in the south of France, you can actually, what's amazing there is, I wouldn't say much about the French coffee, but if you go just over the border, you're straight into Italy.
Yeah.
And there's some amazing places where you can stop and get a really good coffee.
Which coffee do you pick then? And what's your menu? You have a snack, you have sweet or a savory?
I like a little macchiato, so espresso, a little bit of foam, I actually sometimes, quite a lot of the time, especially if I'm stopping later in the day, I actually just take a green tea. I'm a tea drinker. I like a lot of tea.
I've noticed that you have your it's like a protein shaker, but it's always tea in it.
Yeah.
I'm even starting to drink more tea now.
No, I enjoy tea. I think it's more interesting than drinking water. So,
yeah.
quite often if you get over into Italy, then around the winter time, it's pretty hard to resist panini or a piadini, fresh mozzarella, proper prosciutto crudo as well. Yeah, you can't really turn that down when it's offered to you.
So, coffee stop guy. Cool. we're going to have a coffee stop here in France. Heard about there was a nice coffee place down the road here.
You have to bring your own coffee if you stop for coffee in France.
Okay. Your craziest day on a bike.
Craziest day on a bike.
I guess you've had a lot.
I've had a few in my time, yeah. I mean, I think it'd be pretty hard to top the Giro d'Italia Stage 19.
I remember that. That was a pretty crazy day.
I think, and it just got crazier and crazier as the day went on. I mean, it went from, so I mean, just to set the scene, I mean, obviously I'd started off the Giro d'Italia, I crashed before the first time trial.
You went down in Israel.
In Israel, exactly, so I was checking out the course and I just overcooked one of the corners. And
maybe you should stop checking out TT courses, actually.
You
don't have a history
history. It's funny because actually you say that. I came to checking out the TT course at the Dauphiné here and I went into my normal zone where I'm like, okay, I'm going to try and push the corners and see how much I can go around the corners. And actually I was like, hold on a second, you don't know what's on the other side of this corner.
No.
Just take it easy. Yeah. You're going to go just super slow the first time and not going to push anything. So I've learned my lesson now eventually after the few big crashes. That Giro, I started off really on the back foot. I just wasn't myself after that crash and I was just losing time. Every test, every mountaintop finish, I just wasn't feeling myself. After 2 weeks of just hanging on, I think I was almost 4 minutes down in GC. I think I still had this sort of hope in my mind that I'd come round, and that knowing the Giro d'Italia, it's the only Grand Tour that seems that it can really just change in the last week.
Yeah.
You have one,
exactly.
Especially that Giro d'Italia was so heavily loaded in the mountains in that third week. You can have just one bad day if you're leading and you're out the window. And the same if you're not right up there, you have one good day and you could suddenly be right up there. So it's, I had this sort of hope in my mind that I'd be able to find an opportunity, and the cracks had started showing on the stages before. Simon Yates was in the pink jersey and he'd been so dominant the whole race. And then the stage before stage 19, he'd just lost a little bit of time. It was only 10, 15 seconds, but he just couldn't follow the wheel. And it was like, oh, there's cracks there.
Yeah.
And then we had the queen stage of the Giro, and it was going over Col de la Finestra. And then two more big climbs up to Bardonecchia to finish the stage. And I just thought, okay, this is the day. I just have to go all in here. I'm going to try and attack 80 Ks to go and just hope that it's chaos behind and they don't really organize a good chase.
Yeah.
So I got the team to go as hard as possible at the bottom of Finestra and reduce.
That's where I dropped.
I think a lot of people looked at it and thought, oh, it's still like 80, 90 Ks to go. Like, what are these guys going to do here? Like,
yeah.
But I got onto the gravel and I got onto the radio with Kenny Ellison. Squeeze, Kenny, squeeze. Yeah. And he gave one last big pull. And then I just accelerated a little bit up the pace off the top of that. And no one followed me. And it was just...
I've seen that on TV. That's not a small acceleration.
Like, well, yeah.
You were going...
Yeah, I can understand why no one wanted to follow. I was still like 80K to go. So,
yeah.
But that was perfect for me. I was in my own little world there. And I went from going to try and win the stage. That was my first goal, was just to go off and try and win the stage and hopefully move up a couple spots on GC, to actually thinking, hold on, I'm in with a chance of the podium now. And then... And the gap just kept on growing, and it was just incredible. Every time I went down a descent, it was like another 45 seconds more advantage to me. Yeah. And it was like, whoa.
And okay, that long descent, that was not a good descent to be solo on. Like, it was a big road, like after Sestriere. Big road down, like, you stayed on that road for ages.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I went through some pretty dark spots on my own there at the front, especially when it was that big valley road that you're talking about now. Big, wide, almost like a motorway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I think there was a bit of headwind there as well. Mm. And I was beginning to regret it then. But what was sort of pushing me on at that moment was just hearing the time gaps. And I was getting closer and closer to riding myself into the pink jersey. And it was just like, hold on, this is crazy. It's gone from just going to try and win the stage to moving up onto the podium to I could actually win the whole thing here, right now. So I was just like, okay, I don't care about the headwind, nothing. I'm just going to get in an aero as possible position, and I'm just going to keep pushing as hard as I can. And I think behind there were just a whole load of events that happened behind. For example, the chasing group behind with Dumoulin, they decided to wait for Reitenbach to help pull, but he's notoriously bad at descending, and it just felt like every time I did a descent I'd gain so much time. And then it seemed like in the valleys, I think they were watching each other and trying to get Tom was trying to get the other guys to pull, and the other guys didn't want to pull, and there were two guys sitting on, I think. Amador and Carapaz were probably sitting on, I think. And I think they just didn't organize the chase very well, and they just kept on losing time. And I just couldn't believe it. And I was like, okay, well, I've got one climb to go now. I just have to try, and I'm going to give everything I've got now to get up this thing and see what happens at the finish line. And it was just incredible sitting there after the finish, just watching the time.
Watching
the time. And to see that I was in the pink jersey by like 20 something seconds, I was just like, no ways. This is just the most mental day ever on a bike.
Yeah. Was it planned from the morning to go exactly there and do everything like this?
Yeah, I'm very much someone, when I get an idea in my head, I visualize it. I'll picture how I want it to be.
Yeah.
And That was, I can remember speaking to Nicolas Portal, my old former director sportif, who sadly passed away. But I remember going to him with the idea and just saying to him, hey, man, what do you think? This is a little bit like, a little bit out there, a little bit crazy, but I'm not really on GC at the moment. I'm 4 minutes down. Let's go all in today, and I'll try and attack solo on the Finestra.
Yeah.
And he just looked at me with this massive smile, and he's like, "I love it! I love it! Come on, let's make it happen." And yeah, that was it.
Yeah. Do you remember stage 10 of that Giro? The one where I think it was Chavez, he dropped on the first climb. It was like...
Yes, I do remember.
250K stage.
Yeah, I remember.
Full gas all day.
I remember. And they carried on riding all day because Chavez dropped on that first climb.
And you know what? You and Wout Poels, you fucked me before the sprint.
You?
Yeah.
Okay, what happened?
I was in a really good position. And then you came on the inside round this long right-hander. I was like, fucking heck. Then I think it was fifth or I was sixth on that stage.
Was it sprinting for the win?
We were sprinting for third.
Ah, okay.
But
okay.
It would be my first world tour result to be maybe on the podium.
Top three,
assholes.
Was it an uphill finish?
No. It was flat finish. But it was still like 4,500 meters of climbing that day.
Okay.
It was just, I think that's the hardest day I ever had. On a bike.
That was an insane day. Yeah. It was an insane day. Yeah. And my apologies for cutting you in the final.
It's okay.
We always had this like saying in the team, like when we were racing. So when we were racing the Tour de France, we'd always say, okay, guys, Tour de France time. Now, we say sorry in Paris. So you basically, you do what you have to do on the road and you say sorry in Paris, you apologize in Paris. And I think that was very much the mentality of racing. Like if you don't take a gap, someone else will take it. And
I think you end up losing. It's like that in every team. We're all told the same before the race.
It feels like that, yeah.
In the race, you don't have friends. We can talk afterwards.
That's it.
That's what everybody says.
That's it.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, what is your favorite race to go to?
I'd probably have to choose. I mean, I love the Grand Tours. The Grand Tours are just something. They're a special animal. It's unlike anything else. 3 weeks of just day in, day out. I find people's true characters will get tested at some point. You're going to be pushed over the limit. Something will go wrong. You're going to be in a crash. You're going to have mechanicals. And it's about how you deal with those kind of situations. And for me, from the Grand Tours, my favorite's always been the Vuelta.
Yeah.
Always, mainly because of, you've got really hot temperatures, which I've always enjoyed, I guess, growing up in Africa. Meant that I always enjoyed... I'm a fair weather cyclist. The Vuelta for me was always so much less stress than the Tour de France in terms of like
bigger roads and
less stress from a media point of view, public point of view. Yeah. But the racing is incredible. They always put, especially for a GC rider or a climber, they always put like 10, 12 mountaintop finishes in the Vuelta.
Yeah.
Whereas the Tour de France, typically you'd have three or four maybe.
Mm.
So it was always the race that, yeah, it was for me the that would like excite me the most.
Yeah, it was also it was the first Grand Tour you won.
Ended up being the first Grand Tour I ever won. I was given the 2011 victory retrospectively after Kobo had some issues. I came second that year just by, what was it, something like 12 or 14 seconds. So, yeah, it was actually pretty cool to be given the victory there.
Yeah. The Vuelta, okay. What is the worst race for you then? Is the race itself, or it doesn't fit you, bad hotels?
I think as a neo pro with Barloworld back in 2008, I think they realized they just had this kid who knew nothing about cycling, and they put me in every race possible. I think
I checked your Palmares the other day, and there are some quite interesting races there. I think I know what you're gonna say.
races I've never been back to since. I mean, they put me in all the spring classics. I think it was E3, Shell de Price, Genfervogon probably. What was Ronde van Drenthe in Holland? And then going driving through the night to start Paris-Roubaix the next morning as well. And this is just, it's just such a crazy experience for me. I'd basically just fresh out of Africa, arrived on the pro scene, and I had no idea. I mean, I didn't really follow professional cycling that much. I didn't know the races. I didn't know the riders.
But you did, you had seen Roubaix on television.
I'd seen Roubaix on television. I knew that was the race with all the cobbles. Yeah. But I'd never ridden on cobbles before.
Oh, shit.
And I can remember arriving at Roubaix, like 2 a.m, and Roubaix always starts pretty early, so I got like 5 hours sleep, and I just knew nothing about the race. And
the day before, you'd been sitting sideways on the bike in crosswind in flat Holland, and
exactly. And I can remember seeing guys like putting tape around their hands or whatever on the bus. I was like, okay, well, I better put some tape on my hands. Like, I just had no clue what was going on. And I thinking back to that time, I don't think we even had any special like cobble equipment on Team Barloworld back then. I think it was just the normal bike with normal wheels, normal tires. I look back at it now and I'm just like, that was just crazy. No one would do that now.
So how many punctures and shit did you have?
I think I had, I can remember needing to change a wheel once, getting back, I got back to the peloton. I was the last teammate to be with Baden Cook, who was our leader on the day. Yeah. And I think it was somewhere just before the Arenberg, Baden punctured. So I gave him my wheel tried to get back to the peloton afterwards, only to go into the back of a team car that slammed on brakes on the cobbles. And I think I was nowhere near my brakes and just went straight into the back of a team car. Needless to say, I think that was it. I think I got just over 200 k's into the race or whatever, and
you didn't think about going all the way to the velodrome?
No. I think the guys who I was with at that point were all talking about getting off at the feed zone, and I was like, okay. I'm not gonna ride on my own here. So
but is that, that's one of the races where you really want to finish, even if you're out of time limit or whatever, you just want to go to that velodrome. But maybe coming out of Africa, you didn't know about it.
I probably didn't even know there was a velodrome there, until I'd watched it on TV.
You didn't have a slideshow for the final and everything. What I would ask you about here was your post-tour crit in Denmark.
Ah, that was definitely an interesting one. As you know, as a Tour de France winner, you normally get invited to do a whole bunch of like post-tour criteriums.
Yeah.
And I been to a few of them. I'd done a few in like Belgium and Holland, and they're pretty pretty fun events. I mean, you go there and it's more of like a show for the public.
It's a show, yeah.
Yeah, you ride around and it's yeah, I mean, it's good fun. It's good fun, but let's just say
it's also good fun in Denmark.
The winner's not normally the strongest guy in the race. Let's put it that way. Yeah. For most of the criteriums. And I got invited to come over to Denmark and do a criterium. And I thought, oh yeah, that sounds cool. I'm not doing the Vuelta this year. I think I'll give that a go. I'll come come give this criterium a try over in Denmark. And I think I'd taken the flight over. I'd probably
just for the listeners, this is the criterium in Hestin, and it is notorious for being the hardest crit in Denmark.
Hardest crit in the world.
Yeah, probably in the world.
Yeah, little did I know. I mean, I thought I took the flight there and I thought, yeah, we're going to meet the race organizer. He'll explain how things are going to go down and do it and hopefully try and make some plans for the evening, get to see Denmark a little bit. And I wasn't really in like race mode, if you like, but I can remember landing and being picked up by the race organizer, and he basically looked at me and he's like, yeah, you're ready to race, right? I'm like, yeah, of course. And he looked at me, he's like, no, this is you need to be ready, huh? You need to be this is a hard race.
Yeah.
And I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I can remember just, okay, I went there, tried to hang on the best I could. I can't even remember how long I lasted, but
not long.
I hadn't done, I probably hadn't touched a bike properly since winning the Tour de France, like no training days or anything. I'd just been doing like a few criteriums and some time off. And and then I came to this event in Denmark and it was just like, holy moly, these guys are going fast.
I think it was after 20 minutes we got away in a group. It was me, Valgren was there, a few other Danish guys and Kark Andersen. And this was before we were pros. And I think Kai Andersen Søren, he won, and he caught you with one lap.
Oh, it doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me. I can just remember the look on a lot of people's faces, like looking at me like, yeah, you just won the Tour de France? Like,
yeah.
You've just been lapped by
I have a photo somewhere where I'm next guy. To you, actually, and can just see you have snot and spit coming out of your face. Really, not having fun. And I've just found my fall from that day. I had 420 for normalized power.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense why I had stuff flying out of my nose and mouth at the time.
Yeah. Good story. Next one. Who is your nemesis in cycling?
Nemesis. No. I mean, I've had a lot of, obviously, rivalries in my time.
Yeah.
Other GC guys. But I'd probably say, over the years, the guy I've kind of bumped heads with most, given we both had very similar goals a lot of the time, is probably Vincenzo Nibali.
Yeah.
Given we were both GC riders going for the same kind of races, and
you both had your like the peak years at the same time, and.
Yeah, more or less same kind of age category, and I think it's just natural. I mean, I guess being a GC rider, you're always gonna have someone you seem to have a difference in opinion with, and for me, it was probably Nibali over the years.
Yeah. Any examples?
Nothing that really stands out. I mean, more just
fighting every day
in race stuff and. Yeah, like I said, I think more just difference in different ways of doing things, difference in opinions, and just seem to be the one guy I'd always bump heads with.
Yeah, we all have them. So what rituals do you have before a race when you're on the bus? You have anything that's a bit odd, or I know now you do exercises. Have you always been doing that?
Yeah, I've been doing exercises for a few years now. quite often I'd I either try and do exercises on the bus, like more like activation stuff, just to fire like different muscle groups and make sure everything's working and warmed up before going on the bike. Or what I quite like to do sometimes is actually go and ride the first few Ks of the neutral zone when I've got time and we finish our meetings early enough. Go and ride the first few Ks of the neutral zone and even find a quiet place, just stop there, and I'll stop on the side of the road somewhere and do a few exercises, like just to kind of loosen off and get warmed up, and then get into the race.
And on the bus, there's nothing like... I always put my right number on the jersey first, and I always put 10 pins in each number. It has to be 10. Stuff like that. That's a little bit weird. You believe in the soul thing, for example?
Yeah, not really. No. We know Reto's got his baby wipes that he enjoys using before the race, but it's a little bit of a private joke. I don't really have anything... anything strange really that stands out. I mean, I always enjoy having some music on the bus.
Bit of a You're a good DJ.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. I think there's a lot of people out there who might disagree.
and a shout out to the jingle of this, like the guy who made the jingle of this podcast. The DJ, he's called Andreas Kongsted. You put on one of his numbers the other day.
I put on one of his tunes the other day, and I was just like, hey, this is a cool song. And you were like, hey, I know this guy.
I told him, actually, and he said that he would happily come play at your birthday party. Awesome. If you're ever going to have one.
Awesome.
So, growing up in Africa, how did you catch on to cycling?
It's a bit of a strange one, really. It wasn't really as if anyone in my family was really that big into it. It was kind of my own thing. I mean, I loved just being on my bike. It wasn't really about competition or racing, or I was just one of those kids who just like lived on the bike. Like I'd always, it was my mode of transport. It was my freedom, really. It was my wings as a kid to be able to get around, to go and do what I wanted to do, and not having to ask my parents to take me somewhere. And growing up in Africa, I had a lot of independence from a very young age, I think. So I could go out and explore the world as a 6-year-old on my bike. And I used to just go everywhere and anywhere on my bike. Then I really enjoyed mountain biking, doing like tricks and jumps and stuff like that on the bike. I'd spend hours just like jumping and trying to do maneuvers and crashing and falling and learning the hard way. But it was only really when I went to school in South Africa, I think, as a teenager, that I really discovered road cycling and actually the side of cycling that you can actually train to be good at being in an event. Before that, I think it was more just messing around on a bike and enjoying being on a bike.
So how is the environment to become pro and do races there? Because I think for me and for most of Europeans, it's the same. Like we get into a local club and we have races every weekend we go to with the family and do the race, and then you get older and you start to figure out if you can be something
or not.
You had races like
that? Actually, in South Africa, they did have a lot of events.
Yeah.
Most of them are more like, I'd say, very similar to Grand Fondos. It's almost like a mass participation event. Like there'd probably be a few thousand people at every event. But I started off actually even going to these road events with my mountain bike to start off with, and found I was able to keep up with most of the road guys in my group. And I was like, hey, this is kind of cool. I've got a bit of an engine here. Like I can keep up with these guys, and I can remember
on your mountain bike.
On my mountain bike, yeah, exactly. I got some slicks, changed the tires for slicks.
Yeah.
And once that got a bit, I started sort of progressing, and I sort of figured out, okay, I've got to get myself a road bike now. It's getting a bit embarrassing. I'd even like cut the handlebars and everything to make them more narrow and like more streamlined. But it's like, no, okay, this is embarrassing. Now I need to try and get a road bike. And I can remember I saved up for probably about 6 months. I was doing all kinds of like different jobs and things to try and save up and make a bit of money to buy my first bike. Yeah. A road bike.
Which
and
bike did it? Was it?
So I'd actually found a secondhand Colnago. I think I found it in the newspaper of all places, yeah. Like in the classified section of a newspaper. Mm. And I was like, okay.
Campagnolo?
Campag, old Mirage, Campagnolo Mirage.
It's a nice ride.
And I was chuffed to bits with my new bike. And it just grew from there. Like, going to the events on the weekend, I found that I was able to sort of upgrade into different categories. And it was strange though, because racing in South Africa, when I actually started racing, probably sort of 17, 18, like going to proper races and trying to race with my age group and everything, the longest event there was 100 kilometers. They didn't really have anything that we could compare to European terms. Mm. So it was over in two and a half hours of racing. Yeah. It was pretty flat. There weren't really any mountains around Johannesburg. So I didn't really shine at all, to be honest. I mean, I was there in the bunch, but I was always the slowest in the group. Like I couldn't sprint. And it was always like a sprint either from a smaller group or sprint from the breakaway or sprint, just a bunch sprint. So I'd never actually win anything.
No.
But I had this dream of like, I think I was just infected by like the cycling bug at that time. And then that's when I started watching the Tour de France on television. I was just like, yeah, that's the kind of cycling I want to do. Not this 100 kilometer.
So growing up there, you didn't have any stuff of the pros at that time that were like your idols, or who were your heroes back then?
Not really. So, I mean, rewinding a little bit back to my days in Kenya. So once I'd got into road cycling, I kept going back every year to go and visit my mother, who still lived in Kenya. And I got to know the professionals of the Kenyan national team.
Yeah.
And there was one guy who stood out, this Rastafarian guy who was the captain of the Kenyan cycling team.
Yeah.
His name was David Kinja.
Yeah.
And he basically took me in and started, every time I'd go back and visit my mother, I'd probably spend 2 weeks with my mother and I'd probably spend 2 weeks living at his house. He lived in like very basic, in almost like you'd call it probably a township, I guess. But I'd love going and spending time with him, training with him every day. And he taught me so much about cycling that even to this day, like, I sort of, when I'm having a tough day on the bike, I'll go back to the sort of the principles that he would always teach me, just about basically enjoying being on the bike and finding love for the sport.
Yeah.
And there was something really special about what he was doing out there, because I mean, he wasn't living the life of, like, certainly not the life of like the professional cyclists that we're used to. Yeah. In Europe. But he was training a lot of the young kids in the village and like teaching them how to progress and how to look after their bikes and how to train and how to eat. And he started teaching me all these things, and he'd done a few international events and world championships and things, and he shared a few of his stories, and I was just like blown away. I wanted to do what he'd done.
Yeah.
I wanted to get to Europe. I wanted to be on the professional scene.
So you get your contract with Barloworld. That's when you go pro.
Yep.
Did you know already back then, did you have a plan and did you have a goal to be the big champion that you've been the last many years?
No.
Did you back then, like, did you have this vision to say, okay, I'm going to go for this, I'm going to go for the tour?
No, or not at all.
No.
I mean, that first year as a neo pro with Barloworld, I mean, they put me in every race possible.
Scared the shit out of you.
scared me, showed me exactly what pro cycling was all about. And I was just like, whoa, I'm not sure about this.
Yeah.
Took me to the Tour de France in 2008, which was another eye-opening experience altogether. It was just, I mean, I number one, the speed of the race was just incredible. I just had not experienced anything like it. But even though I felt out of my depth, I had one or two days in that tour where I felt I was able to shine. The big sort of queen stage, I guess, going up Alpe d'Huez, I was able to do the first half probably with the front GC group, with Menchoff and some of those guys. I think I came in, 30th as a neo-pro. The final stage 20 before going to Paris, I think it was like a 65k individual time trial. I think I was probably like 15th or something.
14, good memory.
14th.
Yeah.
And then looking at that, I think there were a good few names in front of me who got taken out a couple of years later. So, I think I there were signs there of the potential that I had, but I was still clueless. I mean, I didn't know how to train properly. I didn't know how to race properly. I didn't know where to sit in the peloton. I didn't really know anything really about cycling. I just knew that I enjoyed it. And, I was just so fresh, I guess. It was also quite an eye-opener for me, that 2008 Tour de France, because I'd come in to cycling thinking, okay, the Lance Armstrong years are behind us now, the whole doping scene, the Festina affair and everything. Yeah, that's kind of been broken open. And in my mind, I was so naive. I thought, okay, doping's kind of finished in cycling. Mm. But that 2008 Tour de France was horrendous. I mean, we had the whole of... which team was it then? I can't even remember.
Gerolsteiner
had some problems.
He was third, and
Cole Schumacher
taken out. Yeah,
but we had Ricardo Rico in that tour, and my own teammate, a Spanish guy called Moses, who sat just opposite me on the bus on the second rest day. He was marched out by police. He had just tested positive for EPO, and I was just like, "Holy,
what's going on?
What have I got myself into?" Like, I thought the sport had like turned a corner, and so that was a pretty big shock for me. But it was pretty cool to see from 2008. I think it was 2009, the year afterwards, they introduced the blood passport and testing really ramped up out of competition testing. And I really believe that was a massive turning point in the sport. And thankfully it came at that time, because I don't think I would have survived much longer in that kind of a sport.
Okay. So then after Barloworld, you go to Team Sky. And did they see a thing in you with all, like, to become a Grand Tour guy, or was it a lucky shot getting in there, or like, did they really at you and have a goal with you?
Yeah, certainly being British had a big part to play with that, because I think being the first British Pro Tour team, I think their first goal was probably to get as many Brits from the other teams as possible and put them all together. Mm. I'd like to think they saw some potential in me from those first couple of years of racing at Barloworld, and figured that if they taught me how to train properly, how to eat properly, and look after myself, that I'd be able to develop into a stage racer, which was always my dream. Having done that first Tour de France, I don't think I necessarily saw myself as a rider to go and contend for the overall victory at the tour. I never really thought that in my first years at all. The dream for me was kind of like, okay, maybe one day I'll get in a lucky break and I can try and win a mountain stage. That was like my dream at that point. But I guess with Sky and working for Bradley Wiggins in that 2011 Vuelta, which was just like the turning point of my career. My job was to be there with Bradley in the high mountains. And I just felt like, hold on, I can do this. I can be here. And I was there and the 10 guys left, 5 guys left, 3 guys left. And I'm still here. I'm still pulling. I'm like, hold on, I can be one of the final guys here, yeah. Actually going for a result. So that changed my mentality a little bit and kind of made it a lot more real and serious for me. And yeah. I think from then on, that was, yeah, no looking back.
Yeah, the rest is history from there. Let's finish off. Last topic here is, what do you look forward to the most when the season is over? In general. I guess your big party days are
behind you. Yeah, my big party days are probably behind me. I'm not really going out clubbing much anymore. The biggest thing, to be honest, is now with 2 young kids, spending time with them, doing things that I just don't get to do in the season. I mean, even things like simple things like going hiking and going for a picnic in the mountains or something like that. When I'm in season, I obviously get back from a big training ride. I don't have that much energy to go out and to do stuff with them.
I know about it, and I don't even have kids.
So I mean, there's that side of things. Spending time with the family that I really miss when I'm in season, but also I'd say one of the hardest parts of being a professional cyclist is always paying attention to the diet and always being that little bit hungry. So you're always just burning a little bit. And
so what is your guilt? What is your cheat meal? What is your guilty
pleasure? Trying to lose weight. So yeah, I would say, I mean, anything and everything that you probably shouldn't have during the season, from pizzas to ice cream to chocolates. All the bad things, and living so close to Italy. I mean, we've got amazing choice of food and restaurants there, like proper gelato. We've got proper pizzerias.
Cool. I think we're done. Thank you for doing this talk.
What's your guilty pleasure?
My guilty pleasure.
At the end of a season,
chocolate. Any like milk chocolate, or Ben and Jerry's ice cream.
Oh, I know about Ben and Jerry's.
The brownie fudge. That's.
I'm into the cookie dough.
You can even have a mix. I saw with the cookie dough and the brownie. Yeah. No, I'm as well. I go full when the season is over. Still in my party days. It's
making me hungry now.
Yeah, right. And we have to go to bed. Big awesome. Day coming up tomorrow.
So, great speaking to you, man, and thanks for having me on the podcast.
Thank you so much for doing it, and good night.
Good night, man. Cheers.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.